He hated himself for being afraid. Although he remembered the terrible pain of the bullet smacking through his belly and scrambling his guts, although he could recall the agony of all the subsequent infections and the anguish of the months in the hospital under the shadow of death, although he knew that many other men would have given up when he persevered, and although he knew that his caution and fear were justified by all that he had experienced and survived, he hated himself nonetheless. Thump! Cursing himself, he disengaged the lock, opened the door, found the light switch. He stepped across the threshold. The garage was wide enough for two cars, and his blue Mitsubishi was parked on the far side. The half nearest the house was occupied by his long workbench, racks of tools, cabinets filled with supplies, and the gas-fired forge in which he melted small ingots of silver to pour into the jewelry and buckle molds that he created. The rataplan of the rain was louder here because there was no drop ceiling and the garage roof was not insulated. A damp chill rose off the concrete floor. No one was in the nearer half of the large chamber. None of the storage cabinets had a compartment big enough to hide a man. With the .38 in hand, he circled the car, looked inside it, even eased down onto his creaking knees and peered under it. Nobody was hiding there. The exterior man-sized door of the garage was locked from the inside. So was the only window, which in any case was too small to admit anyone older than 5. He wondered if the noise had originated on the roof. For a minute, 2 minutes, he stood beside the car, staring up at the rafters, waiting for the thump to come again. Nothing. Just rain, rain, rain. An unceasing tattoo. Feeling foolish, Ricky returned to the house and locked the connecting door. He took the revolver into the kitchen with him and put it on the built-in secretary beside the telephone. The flames under both the pasta and sauce had gone out. For a moment he thought the gas service had failed, but then he saw that the knobs in front of both burners were in the off position. He knew that they'd been on when he left the kitchen. He turned them on again, and the blue flames came to life with a whoosh under the pots. After adjusting them to the right intensity, he stared at them for a while. The flames did not subside of their own accord. Somebody was playing games with him. He returned to the secretary, picked up the gun, and considered searching the house again. But he had already inspected every inch of the place and knew for certain that he was alone. Following a brief hesitation, he searched it again with the same result as the first time. When he returned to the kitchen, no one had turned off the gas. The sauce was boiling so rapidly, it had begun to stick to the bottom of the pot. He put the gun aside. He speared a piece of rigatoni with a large fork, blew on it to cool it, tasted. It was slightly overcooked, but okay. He drained the pasta into a colander in the sink, shook the colander, dumped the pasta on a plate, and added sauce. Somebody was playing games with him, but who? Rain drizzled through the leafy oleander bushes and countered the layers of plastic garbage bags that Sammy had draped across the packing crate and drained off the plastic into the vacant lot or out into the alleyway. Under the rags that served as bedding, the floor of the crate was also lined with plastic, so his humble home was relatively dry. Even if he had been sitting in water up to his waist, Sammy Shamro might not have noticed, for he had already finished one double-liter jug of wine and had started a second. He was feeling no pain, or at least that's what he told himself. He had it pretty good, really. The cheap wine kept him warm, temporarily purged him of self-hatred and remorse, and put him in touch with certain innocent feelings and naive expectations of childhood. Two fat blueberry-scented candles salvaged from someone else's garbage and anchored now in a pie pan filled his sanctuary with a pleasant fragrance and a soft light as cozy as that from an antique Tiffany lamp. The close walls of the packing crate were comforting rather than claustrophobic. The ceaseless chorus of the rain was lulling. But for the candles, perhaps it had been something like this in the sack of fetal membranes. Snugly housed, suspended weightless in amniotic fluid, surrounded by the soft, liquid roar of mother's blood rushing through her veins and arteries, not merely unconcerned about the future, but unaware of it. Even when the rat man pulled aside the hanging rug that served as a door over the only opening in the crate, Sammy was not delivered from his imitation prenatal bliss. Deep down, he knew that he was in trouble, but he was too whacked to be afraid. The crate was 8 feet by 6, as large as many walk-in closets. Bearish as he was, the Ratman still could have squeezed in across from Sammy without knocking over the candles, but he remained crouched in the doorway, holding back the rug with one arm. His eyes were different from what they had always been before. Shiny black, without any whites at all. Pinpoint yellow pupils in the center, glowing, like distant headlights on the night highway to hell.
"How are you doing, Sammy?"
the Ratman asked in a tone of voice that was uncharacteristically solicitous.
"You getting along okay?
Though a surfeit of wine had so numbed Sammy Shamro's survival instinct that he couldn't get back in touch with his fear, he knew that he should be afraid. Therefore, he remained motionless and watchful, as he might have done if a rattlesnake had slithered into his crate and blocked the only way out. The Ratman said,
"Just wanted you to know I won't be stopping around for a while. Got new business. Overworked. Gotta deal with more urgent matters first. When it's over, I'll be exhausted. Sleep for a whole day around the clock."
Being temporarily fearless did not mean that Sammy had become courageous. He dared not speak.
"Did you know how much this exhausts me, Sammy? No. Thinning out the herd, disposing of the lame and the diseased. It's no piece of cake, let me tell you."
When the Ratman smiled and shook his head, shining beads of rainwater were flung off his beard. They spattered Sammy. Even in the comforting womb of his wine haze, Sammy retained enough awareness to be amazed by the Ratman's sudden garrulousness. Yet as amazing as it was, the huge man's monologue was curiously reminiscent of something he had heard before a long time ago in another place, although he could not recall where or when or from whom. It wasn't the gravelly voice or the words themselves that brought Sammy to the edge of déjà vu, but the tonal quality of the Ratman's revelations, the eerie earnestness, the cadences of his speech.
"Dealing with vermin like you," Ratman said, "is draining. Believe me, draining. It'd be so much easier if I could waste each of you the first time we meet, make you spontaneously combust, or make your head explode. Wouldn't that be nice?"
No. Colorful, exciting, interesting for sure, but not nice, Sammy thought, although his fear remained in abeyance.
"But to fulfill my destiny,"
the Ratman said,
"to become what I am required to become, I have to show you my wrath, make you quiver and be humbled before me, make you understand the meaning of your damnation."
Sammy remembered where he had heard this sort of thing before. Another street person, maybe 18 months ago, 2 years ago, up in Los Angeles. A guy named Mike had a messiah complex, thought he was chosen by God to make the world pay for its sins, finally went over the top with the concept, knifed 3 or 4 people who were lined up outside an art house theater that was showing a re-released director's cut of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, with 20 minutes of material never seen in the original version.
"Do you know what I am becoming, Sammy?"
Sammy just clutched his remaining 2-liter jug.
"I am becoming the new God," said the Ratman. "A new God is needed. I have been chosen. The old God was too merciful. Things have gotten out of hand. It's my duty to become, and having become, to rule more sternly."
In the candlelight, the raindrops remaining in the Ratman's hair and eyebrows and beard glimmered as if a woefully misguided artisan had decorated him with jewels in the manner of a Fabergé egg.
"When I deal out these more urgent judgments, and when I've had a chance to rest, I'll be back to see you,"
the Ratman promised.
"I just didn't want you to think you'd been forgotten. Wouldn't want you to feel neglected, unappreciated. Poor, poor Sammy. I won't forget you. That's not just a promise. It's the sacred word of the new God."
Then the Ratman worked a malevolent miracle to ensure that he was not forgotten, even in the thousand-fathom oblivion of a deep wine sea. He blinked, and when his lids popped up again, his eyes were no longer ebony and yellow, were not eyes at all any longer, but were balls of greasy white worms writhing in his sockets. When he opened his mouth, his teeth had become razor-sharp fangs. Venom dripped, a glossy black tongue fluttered like that of a questing serpent, and a violent exhalation erupted from him, reeking of putrefied flesh. His head and body swelled, burst, but didn't deconstruct into a horde of rats this time. Instead, Ratman and clothes were transformed into tens of thousands of black flies that swarmed through the packing crate, buzzing fiercely, batting against Sammy's face. The thrumming of their wings was so loud that it drowned out even the drone of the pouring rain, and then they were gone, vanished. The rug hung heavy and wet over the open section of the crate. Candle glow flickered and pulsed across the wooden walls. The air smelled of blueberry-scented wax. Sammy chugged a couple of long swallows of wine directly from the mouth of the jug, instead of pouring it first into the dirty jelly jar that he had been using. A little of it spilled over his whisker-stubbled chin, but he didn't care. He was eager to remain numb, detached. If he had been in touch with his fear during the past few minutes, he would no doubt have peed his pants. He felt it was also important to remain detached in order to think less emotionally about what the Ratman had said. Previously, the creature had spoken little and had never revealed anything of its own motivations or intentions. Now it was spouting all this babble about thinning the herd, judgment, godhood. It was valuable to know the Ratman's mind was filled with the same crazy stuff that had cluttered up the head of old Mike, stabber of moviegoers. Regardless of his ability to appear out of nowhere and disappear into thin air, in spite of his inhuman eyes and ability to change shapes, all of that god blather made him seem hardly more special than any of the countless heirs of Charles Manson and Richard Ramirez who roamed the world heeding inner voices, killing for pleasure, and keeping refrigerators filled with the severed heads of their victims. If in some fundamental way he was like the other psychos out there, then even with his special talents he was as vulnerable as they were. Though functioning in a wine fog, Sammy could see that this new insight might be a useful survival tool. The problem was, he had never been good at survival. Thinking about the Ratman made his head hurt. Hell, the mere prospect of surviving gave him a migraine. Who wanted to survive? And why? Death would only come later, if not sooner. Each survival was merely a short-term triumph. In the end, oblivion for everyone. And in the meantime, nothing but pain. To Sammy, it seemed that the only terrible thing about the Ratman was not that he killed people, but that he apparently liked to make them suffer first, cranked up the terror, poured on the pain, did not remove his victims from this world with kindly dispatch. Sammy tipped the jug and poured wine into the jelly jar that was on the floor, braced between his splayed legs. He raised the glass to his lips. In the glimmering ruby liquid, he sought a glimmerless, peaceful, perfect darkness. Mickey Chan was sitting alone in a back booth, concentrating on his soup. Connie saw him as soon as she pushed through the front door of the small Chinese restaurant in Newport Beach, and she made her way toward him between black lacquered chairs and tables with silver-gray tablecloths. A red and gold painted dragon coiled across the ceiling, serpentined around the light fixtures. If Mickey saw her coming, he pretended to be unaware. He sucked soup from the spoon, then spooned up more, never taking his gaze off the contents of his bowl. He was small but sinewy in his late 40s and wore his hair closely cropped. His skin was the shade of antique parchment. Although he allowed his Caucasian clients to think that he was Chinese, he was actually a Vietnamese refugee who had fled to the States after the fall of Saigon. Rumor had it he'd been a Saigon homicide detective or an officer in the South Vietnamese Internal Security Agency, which was probably true. Some said that he'd had a reputation as a real terror in the interrogation room, a man who would resort to any tool or technique to break the will of a suspected criminal or communist, but Connie doubted those stories. She liked Mickey. He was tough, but he had about him the air of a man who had known great loss and was capable of profound compassion. As she reached his table, he spoke to her without shifting his attention from the soup. "Good evening, Connie," She slid into the other side of the booth. You're fixated on that bowl as if the meaning of life is in it.
It is, he said, still spooning.
It is. It looks like soup to me.
The meaning of life can be found in a bowl of soup. Soup always begins with a broth of some kind, which is like the liquid flow of days that makes up our lives.
Broth?
Sometimes in the broth are noodles, sometimes vegetables, bits of egg white, slivers of chicken or shrimp, mushrooms, perhaps rice.
Because Mickey would not look at her, Connie found herself staring across the table at his soup almost intensely as he was.
He said, sometimes it is hot, sometimes cool. Sometimes it is meant to be cool, and then is good even if there's no slightest warmth in it. But if it's not meant to be cool, then it will taste bitter, or curdle in the stomach, or both.
His strong but gentle voice had a hypnotic effect. Enthralled, Connie stared at the placid surface of the soup, oblivious now to everyone else in the restaurant.
Consider, before the soup is eaten, Mickey said, it has value and purpose. After it is eaten, it is valueless to everyone except to whomever has consumed it. And in fulfilling its purpose, it ceases to exist. Left behind will only be the empty bowl, which can symbolize either want and need or the pleasant expectation of other soups to come.
She waited for him to continue and only shifted her gaze from his soup when she realized that he was now staring at her. She met his eyes and said,
"That's it?"
"Yes."
"The meaning of life?"
"All of it."
She frowned.
"I don't get it."
He shrugged. "Me neither. I make up this crap as I go along."
She blinked at him.
"You what?"
Grinning, Mickey said, "Well, it's sort of expected of a Chinese private detective, you see. Pithy sayings, impenetrable philosophical observations, inscrutable proverbs." He was not Chinese, nor was his real name Mickey Chan. When he arrived in the U.S. and decided to put his police background to use by becoming a private detective, he had felt that Vietnamese names were too exotic to inspire confidence and too difficult for Westerners to pronounce. And he'd known he couldn't make a good living solely from clients of Vietnamese heritage. Two of his favorite American things were Mickey Mouse cartoons and Charlie Chan movies, and it made sense to him to have his name legally changed. Because of Disney and Rooney and Mantle and Spillane, Americans liked people named Mickey. And thanks to a lot of old movies, the name Chan was subconsciously associated with investigative genius. Evidently, Mickey had known what he was doing because he had built a thriving business with a sterling reputation and now had 10 employees.
"You suckered me," she said, indicating the soup.
"You're not the first."
Amused, she said, "If I could pull the right strings, I'd have the courts change your name to Charlie Mouse. See how that works."
"I'm glad you can still smile," Mickey said.
A beautiful young waitress with jet black hair and almond eyes appeared at the table and asked if Connie would like to order dinner.
"Just a bottle of Qingdao, please,"
Connie said. And to Mickey,
"I don't feel much like smiling if you want to know the truth. You sure as hell ruined my day with that call this morning."
"Ruined your day? Me?
Who else?"
"Maybe a certain gentleman with a Browning and a few grenades."
"So you heard about that?"
"Who hasn't? Even in Southern California, it's kind of story that gets on the news ahead of the sports report."
"On a slow day, maybe," said Connie. He finished his soup. The waitress returned with the beer. Connie poured the Qingdao down the side of the chilled Pilsner glass to minimize the head, took a sip, and sighed.
"I'm sorry," Mickey said sincerely. "I know how much you wanted to believe you had a family."
"I did have a family," she said. "They're just all gone."
Between the ages of 3 and 18, Connie had been raised in a series of state institutions and temporary foster homes, each more abysmal than the one before it, requiring her to be tough and to fight back. Because of her personality, she had not appealed to adoptive parents and could not escape by that route. Certain of her character traits, which she saw as strengths, were considered attitude problems by other people. From the youngest age, she had been independent-minded, solemn beyond her years, virtually unable to be a child. To act her age, she literally would have had to act, for she had been an adult in a child's body. Until 7 months ago, she had not given much thought to the identity of her parents. There seemed to be no percentage in caring.
For whatever reason, they had abandoned her as a child, and she had no memory whatsoever of them. Then one sunny Sunday afternoon, when she went skydiving out of the airfield at Paris, her ripcord jammed. She fell 4,000 feet toward brown desert scrub as arid as hell, with the conviction that she was dead except for the actual dying. Her chute deployed at the last possible moment to allow survival. Although her landing was rough, she was lucky. It resulted only in a sprained ankle, a braided left hand, bruises, and a sudden need to know where she'd come from. Everyone had to exit this life without a clue as to where they were going, so it seemed essential to know at least something about the entrance. During off-duty hours, she could have used official channels, contacts, and computers to investigate her past, but she preferred Mickey Chan. She didn't want her colleagues getting involved with her search, pulling for her and curious, in case she found something she didn't want to share with them. As it turned out, what Mickey had learned after 6 months of prying into official files was not pretty. When he handed her the report in his stylish Fashion Island office with its 19th century French art and Biedermeier furniture, he said, "I'll be in the next room, dictating some letters. You let me know when you're finished." His Asian reticence, the implication that she might need to be alone, alerted her to just how bad the truth was. According to Mickey's report, a court had removed her from the care of her parents because she had suffered repeated severe physical abuse. As punishment for unknown transgressions, perhaps merely for being alive, they beat her, shaved off all her hair, blindfolded her, and tied her and left her in a closet for 18 hours at a stretch, and broke 3 of her fingers. When remanded to the care of the court, she had not yet learned to speak, for her parents had never taught or permitted her to talk. But speech had come quickly to her, as if she relished the rebellion that the mere act of speaking represented. However, she never had the opportunity to accuse her mother and father. While fleeing the state to avoid prosecution, they had died in a fiery head-on collision near the California-Arizona border. Connie read Mickey's first report with grim fascination, less shaken by its contents than most people would have been, because she had been a cop long enough to have seen the likes of it many times, and worse. She did not feel that the hatred directed against her had been earned by her shortcomings or because she had been less lovable than other kids. It was just how the world worked sometimes. Too often. At least she finally understood why, even at the tender age of 3, she had been too solemn, too wise beyond her years, too independent-minded, just too damn tough to be the cute and cuddly girl that adoptive parents were seeking. The abuse must have been worse than the dry language of the report made it sound. For one thing, courts usually tolerated a lot of parental brutality before taking such drastic action. For another, she had blocked all memories of it and of her sister, which was an act of some desperation. Most children who survived such experiences grew up deeply troubled by their repressed memories and feelings of worthlessness, or even utterly dysfunctional. She was fortunate to be one of the strong ones. She had no doubts about her value as a human being or her specialness as an individual. Though she might have enjoyed being a gentler person, more relaxed, less cynical, quicker to laugh, she nevertheless liked herself and was content in her own way. Mickey's report hadn't contained entirely bad news. Connie learned that she had a sister of whom she'd been unaware, Colleen, Constance Mary and Colleen Marie Gulliver, the former born 3 minutes before the latter, identical twins. Both abused, both permanently removed from parental care, eventually sent to different institutions, they had gone on to lead separate lives. As she sat in the client chair that day a month ago in front of Mickey's desk, a shiver of delight had swept along Connie's spine at the realization that someone existed with whom she shared such a singularly intimate bond. Identical twins. She abruptly understood why she sometimes dreamed of being two people at once, and appeared in duplicate in those sleeping fantasies. Though Mickey was still seeking leads on Colleen, Connie dared to hope she was not alone. But now, a few weeks later, Colleen's fate was known. She had been adopted, raised in Santa Barbara, and died 5 years ago at the age of 28. That morning, when Connie learned she had lost her sister again, and forever this time, she had known a more intense grief than at any time in her life. She had not wept. She seldom did. Instead, she had dealt with that grief as she dealt with all disappointments, setbacks, and losses. She kept busy, obsessively busy, and she got angry. Poor Harry. He had taken the brunt of her anger all morning without having a clue as to the cause of it. Polite, reasonable, peace-loving, long-suffering Harry.
He would never know just how perversely grateful she had been for the chance to chase down the moon-faced perp, James Ordegard. She had been able to direct her rage at someone more deserving of it and work off the pent-up energy of the grief she could not release through tears. Now she drank Qingdao and said, "This morning you mentioned photographs." The busboy removed the empty soup bowl. Mickey put a manila envelope on the table. "Are you sure you want to look at them?"
"Why wouldn't I?"
"You can never know her. The pictures might bring that home."
"I've already accepted it."
The photos showed Colleen as young as 5 or 6, as old as her mid-20s, which was nearly as old as she had ever gotten. She wore different clothes from those that Connie had ever worn, styled her hair differently, and was photographed in living rooms and kitchens, on lawns and beaches, that Connie had never seen. But in every fundamental way, height, weight, coloration, facial features, even expressions and unconscious body attitudes, she was Connie's perfect double. Connie had the uncanny feeling that she was seeing photos of herself in a life that she could not remember having lived.
"Where did you get these?" she asked Mickey Chan.
"From the Ladbrokes, Dennis and Lorraine Ladbroke, a couple that adopted Colleen." Examining the photographs again, Connie was struck by the fact that Colleen was smiling or laughing in every one of them. The few pictures that had ever been taken of Connie as a child were usually institutional group shots with a group of other kids. She didn't have a single photograph of herself in which she was smiling.
"What are the Ladbrokes like?" she asked.
"They're in business. They work together, own an office supply store in Santa Barbara. Nice people, I think. Quiet and unassuming. They weren't able to have any children of their own, and they adored Colleen." Envy darkened Connie's heart. She coveted the love and years of normality that Colleen had known. Irrational to envy a dead sister. And shameful. But she could not help herself. Mickey said, "The Ladbrokes hadn't gotten over her death, not even after 5 years. They didn't know she was a twin. They were never given that information by the child welfare agencies." Connie returned the photographs to the manila envelope, unable to look at them any longer. Self-pity was an indulgence that she loathed, but that's what her envy was swiftly becoming. A heaviness, like piled stones, pressed upon her breast. Later, in the privacy of her apartment, maybe she would feel like spending more time with her sister's lovely smile. The waitress arrived with mugu gaipan and rice for Mickey. Ignoring the chopsticks that were provided with a regular complement of flatware, Mickey picked up his fork.
"Connie, the Ladbrokes would like to meet you."
"Why?"
"Like I said, they never knew Colleen had a twin."
"I'm not sure it's a good idea. I can't be Colleen for them. I'm someone different."
"I don't think it would be like that."
After she drank some beer, she said, "I'll think about it." Mickey dug into his mugu gaipan as if nothing tastier had ever come out of any kitchen in the Western Hemisphere. The look and smell of the food made Connie half ill. She knew that nothing was wrong with the dinner, only her reaction to it. She had more than one reason to be queasy. It had been a hard day. Finally, she asked the dreadful question that remained. "How did Colleen die?" Mickey studied her for a moment before answering.
"I was ready to tell you this morning."
"I wasn't ready to hear, I guess."
"Childbirth."
Connie had been prepared for any of the stupid and pointless ways that death could come suddenly to an attractive 28-year-old woman in these dark terminal years of the millennium. She had not been prepared for this, however, and it jolted her.
"She had a husband?" she said.
Mickey shook his head.
"No. Unwed mother. I don't know the circumstances, who the father was, but it doesn't seem to be a sore point with the Ladbrokes. Nothing they consider a stain on her memory. She was a saint in their eyes."
"What about the baby?"
"A girl."
"She lived?"
"Yes," Mickey said.
He put down his fork, drank some water, blotted his mouth with a red napkin, watching Connie all the while.
"Her name is Eleanor. Eleanor Ladbroke. They call her Ellie."
"Ellie," Connie said numbly.
"She looks a great deal like you."
"Why didn't you tell me this morning?"
"You didn't give me a chance. You hung up on me."
"I didn't," she said.
"Just about. Very brusque you were. Tell me the rest this evening," you said.
sorry. When I heard Colleen was dead, I thought it was over.
Now you have a family. You're someone's aunt.
She accepted the reality of Ellie's existence, but she could not yet begin to get a handle on what Ellie might mean to her own life, her future. After having been alone for so long, she was stunned to learn for certain that someone of her own flesh and blood was also alive in this vast and troubled world.
Having family somewhere, even one, must make a difference, Mickey said.
She suspected it would make a huge difference. Ironically, earlier in the day, she had nearly been killed before learning that she had one very important new reason to live. Putting another manila envelope on the table, Mickey said,
The final report. The Ladbrokes' address and phone numbers in there when you decide you need them.
Thank you, Mickey.
And the bill. It's in there, too.
She smiled. Thank you, anyway. As Connie slid out of the booth and stood, Mickey said,
Life's funny. So many connections with other people that we don't even know about. Invisible threads linking us to some we've long forgotten and some we won't meet for years, if ever.
Yeah, funny.
One more thing, Connie.
What's that?
There's a Chinese saying that goes, Sometimes life can be as bitter as dragon tears.
This more of your crap?
Oh, no. It's a real saying.
Sitting there, a small man in a large booth with his gentle face and crinkled eyes full of good humor, Mickey Chan seemed like a thin Buddha.
Well, that's only part of the saying, the part you already understand. The whole thing goes, Sometimes life can be as bitter as dragon tears, but whether dragon tears are bitter or sweet depends entirely on how each man perceives the taste.
In other words, life is hard, even cruel, but it's also what you make of it, said Connie. Putting his slender hands flat together without interleaving his fingers in the position of oriental prayer, Mickey bowed his head in her direction with mock solemnity.
Perhaps wisdom may yet enter through the thick bone of your Yankee head.
Anything's possible, she admitted. She left with the two manila envelopes, her sister's captured smile, the promise of her niece. Outside, rain was still coming down at a rate that made her wonder if a new Noah was at work somewhere in the world, even now marching pairs of animals up a boarding gangway. The restaurant was in a new strip shopping center, and a deep overhang kept the pedestrian walkway dry. A man was standing to the left of the door. Peripheral vision gave Connie the impression that he was tall and husky, but she didn't actually look at him until he spoke to her.
Have mercy on a poor man, will you please? Mercy for a poor man, lady?
She was about to step off the curb, out from under the overhang, but his voice was arresting. Soft, gentle, even musical, it seemed radically out of sync with the size of the person she had seen from the corner of her eye. Turning, she was surprised by the formidable ugliness of the man, and wondered how he could possibly earn even a meager living as a beggar. His unusual size, knotted hair, and unkempt beard gave him the mad aspect of Rasputin, though that crazed Russian priest had been a pretty boy by comparison. Terrible bands of scar tissue disfigured his face, and his bleak nose was dark with broken blood vessels. His lips were marked by oozing blisters. One glimpse of his diseased teeth and gums reminded her of those in a corpse she had once seen after it had been exhumed for poison tests 9 years after burial. And the eyes. Cataracts. Thick, milky membranes. She could barely see the dark circles of the irises underneath. His appearance was so threatening that Connie imagined most people, upon being panhandled by him, turned and fled rather than approach to press money into his extended hand.
Mercy on a poor man? Mercy on the blind? Spare change for one less fortunate than you?
The voice was extraordinary in its own right, but doubly so considering the source. Clear, melodious, it was the instrument of a born singer who would deliver every lyric sweetly. It must be the voice alone that, in spite of his appearance, made it possible for him to live as a mendicant. Ordinarily, in spite of his voice, Connie would have told him to buzz off, though not so politely. Some beggars became homeless by no fault of their own, and having experienced homelessness of a kind when she'd been an institutionalized child, she had compassion for the genuinely victimized. But her job required daily contact with too many street people for her to be able to romanticize them as a class. In her experience, many were gravely demented and for their own sakes belonged in the mental institutions from which do-gooders had mainstreamed them, while others had earned their perdition through alcohol, drugs, or gambling. She suspected that in every strata of society, from the mansion to the gutter, the genuinely innocent were a distinct minority. For some reason, however, although this guy looked as if he had made every bad decision and self-destructive choice it was within his power to make, she fished in her jacket pockets until she found a couple of quarters and a $10 bill, soft with age. To her greater surprise, she kept the quarters and gave him the $10.
"Bless you, lady. God bless you and keep you and make his face to shine upon you."
Astonished at herself, she turned away from him. She hurried out into the rain toward her car. As she ran, she wondered what had possessed her. But it really wasn't hard to figure. She had been given more than one gift during the course of the day. Her life had been spared in the pursuit of Ortegard, and they had nailed the creep. And then there was 5-year-old Eleanor Ladbrook, Ellie, a niece. Connie could not recall many days as fine as that, and she supposed her good fortune had put her in the mood to give something back when an opportunity arose. Her life, one wasted perp, and a new direction for her future. Not a bad trade for $10. She got in the car, slammed the door. She already had the keys in her right hand. She switched on the engine and gunned it because it chugged a little as if protesting the weather. Suddenly, she was aware that her left hand was clenched in a tight fist. She wasn't conscious of having made the fist. It was as if her hand had closed in a lightning-quick spasm. Something was in her hand. She uncurled her fingers to look at what she held. The parking lot lamp shed enough light through the rain-smeared windshield for her to see the crumpled item. A $10 bill, worn soft with age. She stared at it in confusion, then with growing disbelief. It must be the same $10 she thought she had given to the beggar. But she had given the money to the tramp, had seen his grimy mitt close around it as he babbled his gratitude. Bewildered, she looked through the side window of the car toward the Chinese restaurant. The beggar was no longer there. She scanned the entire pedestrian walkway. He was nowhere in front of the strip shopping center. She stared at the crumpled money. Gradually, her good mood faded. She was overcome by dread. She had no idea why she should be afraid. And then she did. Cop instinct. Harry took longer than he expected to get home from special projects. Traffic moved sluggishly, repeatedly clogging up at flooded intersections. He lost more time when he stopped at a 7-Eleven to get a couple of things he needed for dinner, a loaf of bread, mustard. Every time he went into a convenience store, Harry thought of Ricky Estefan stopping after work that day for a quart of milk and buying a drastic life change instead. But nothing bad happened in the 7-Eleven except that he heard the story about the baby and the birthday party. A small television on the checkout counter kept the clerk entertained when business was slow, and it was turned to the news while Harry was paying for his purchases. A young mother in Chicago had been charged with murdering her own infant child. Her relatives had planned a big birthday party for her, but when her babysitter failed to show up, it had looked as if she wouldn't be able to go and enjoy herself. So she dumped her 2-month-old infant down the chute of her apartment building trash incinerator, went to the party, and danced up a storm. Her lawyer had already said her defense would be postpartum depression. Yet another example of the continuing crisis for Connie's collection of outrages and atrocities. The clerk was a slender young man with dark, sorrowful eyes. In Iranian-accented English, he said, "What's this country coming to?" "Sometimes I wonder," Harry said. "But then again, in your former country, they don't just let the lunatics run around free. They actually put them in charge." "True," the clerk said. "But here, too, sometimes." "Can't argue that." As he was pushing through one of the glass doors on his way out of the store with the bread and mustard in a plastic bag, Harry suddenly realized he was carrying a folded newspaper under his right arm. He stopped with the door half open, took the paper from under his arm, and stared at it uncomprehendingly. He was sure he had not picked up a paper, let alone folded one and put it under his arm. He returned to the cash register. When he put the paper on the counter, it unfolded. "Did I pay for this?" Harry asked. Puzzled, the clerk said, "No, sir, I didn't even see you pick it up." "I don't remember picking it up." "Did you want it?" said the clerk. "No, not really." Then he noticed the headline at the top of the front page, Shootout at Laguna Beach Restaurant, and the subhead, 2 dead, 10 wounded. It was the late edition with the first story about Ordegard's bloody rampage.
Wait, Harry said. Yes, I guess I'll take it.
On those occasions when one of his cases became newsworthy, Harry never read about himself in the papers. He was a cop, not a celebrity. He gave the clerk a quarter and took the evening edition. He still didn't understand how the paper had gotten folded and tucked under his arm. Blackout? Or something stranger, more directly related to the other inexplicable events of the day? When Harry opened the front door and dripping stepped into the foyer of his condominium, home had never seemed so inviting. It was a neat and ordered haven into which the chaos of the outside world could not intrude. He took off his shoes. They were saturated, probably ruined. He should have worn galoshes, but the weather report had not called for rain until after nightfall. His socks were wet, too, but he left them on. He would mop the foyer tile after he changed into clean, dry clothes. He stopped in the kitchen to put the bread and mustard on the counter beside the cutting board. Later, he would make sandwiches with some cold poached chicken. He was starved. The kitchen sparkled. He was so pleased that he had taken the time to clean up the breakfast mess before going to work. He would have been depressed to see it now. From the kitchen, he went through the dining room, down the short hall to the master bedroom, carrying the evening newspaper. As he crossed the threshold, he snapped on the lights and discovered the hobo on his bed. Alice never fell down any rabbit hole deeper than the one into which Harry dropped at the sight of the vagrant. The man seemed even bigger than he had been out of doors or from a distance in the special projects corridor. Dirtier, more hideous. He did not have the semi-transparency of an apparition. In fact, with his masses of tangled hair and intricately layered varieties of grime and webwork of scars, with his dark clothes so wrinkled and tattered that they recalled the interment wrappings of an ancient Egyptian mummy, he was more real than the room itself, like a painstakingly detailed figure painted by a photorealist and then inserted into a minimalist's line drawing of a room. The tramp's eyes opened, like pools of blood. He sat up and said,
"You think you're so special, but you're just one more animal, walking meat like all the rest of them."
Dropping the newspaper, pulling his revolver from his shoulder holster, Harry said, "Don't move." Ignoring the warning, the intruder swung his legs over the side of the bed, got up. The impression of the vagrant's head and body remained in the spread pillows and mattress. A ghost could walk through snow, leaving no footprints, and hallucinations had no weight.
"Just another diseased animal."
If anything, the vagrant's voice was deeper and raspier than it had been on the street in Laguna Beach, the guttural voice of a beast that had laboriously learned to talk.
"Think you're a hero, don't you? Big man, big hero. Well, you're nothing, less than a pissant. That's what you are. Nothing."
Harry couldn't believe it was going to happen again, not twice in one day, and for God's sake, not in his own home. Backing up one step into the doorway, he said,
"You don't lie down on the floor right now, on your face, hands behind your back, right now. So help me God, I'll blow your head off."
Starting around the bed toward Harry, the vagrant said,
"You think you can shoot anyone you like, push anyone around if you want, and that's the end of it. But that's not the end of it with me. Shooting me is never the end of it."
"Stop right now, I mean it."
The intruder didn't stop. His moving shadow was huge on the wall.
"Rip your guts out. Hold them in your face. Make you smell them while you die."
Harry had the revolver in both hands, a shooter's stance. He knew what he was doing. He was a good marksman. He could have hit a flitting hummingbird at such close range, let alone this great looming hulk, so there was only one way it could end. The intruder as cold as a side of beef, blood all over the walls, only plausible scenario. Yet he felt in greater danger than ever before in his life, infinitely more vulnerable than he had been among the mannequins in the box maze attic.
"You people,
the vagrant said, rounding the foot of the bed,
"are so much fun to play with."
One last time, Harry ordered him to stop, but he kept coming, maybe 10 feet away. 8, 6. Harry opened fire, squeezing shots off nice and smooth, not letting the hard recoil of the handgun pull the muzzle off target. Once, twice, 3 times, 4, and the explosions were deafening in the small bedroom. He knew every round did damage, 3 in the torso, the 4th in the base of the throat from only inches more than arm's length, causing the head to snap around as if doing a comic double take. The hobo didn't go down, didn't stagger backward, only jerked with each hit he took. Inflicted point blank, the throat wound was ghastly. The bullet must have punched all the way through, leaving an even worse exit wound on the back of the neck, fracturing or severing the spine. But there was no blood, no spray or spout, or smallest spurt, as if the man's heart had stopped beating long ago, and all the blood had dried and hardened in his vessels. He kept coming, no more stoppable than an express train, rammed into Harry, knocking the wind out of him, lifting him, carrying him backward through the doorway, slamming him so hard against the far hallway wall that Harry's teeth snapped together with an audible clack, and the revolver flipped out of his hand. Pain spread like a Japanese accordion fan from the small of Harry's back across both shoulders. For a moment, he thought he was going to black out, but terror kept him conscious. Pinned to the wall, feet dangling off the floor, stunned by the plaster-cracking force with which he'd been hammered, he was as helpless as a child in the iron grip of his assailant. But if he could remain conscious, his strength might flood back into him, or maybe he would think of something to save himself, anything, a move, a trick, a distraction. The hobo leaned against Harry, crushing him. The nightmarish face loomed closer. The livid scars were encircled by enlarged pores the size of matchheads packed with filth. Tufts of wiry black hair bristled from his flared nostrils. When the man exhaled, it was like a mass grave venting the gases of decomposition, and Harry choked in revulsion.
"Scared, little man?"
the vagrant asked, and his ability to speak seemed unaffected by the hole in his throat and the fact that his vocal cords had been pulverized and blown out through the back of his neck.
"Scared?"
Harry was scared, yes. He would have been an idiot if he hadn't been scared. No amount of weapons training or police work prepared you for going face to face with a boogeyman, and he didn't mind admitting it, was prepared to shout it from a rooftop if that's what the vagrant wanted, but he couldn't get his breath to speak.
"Sunrise in 11 hours,
the hobo said.
Tick, tock.
Things were moving in the depths of the tramp's bushy beard, crawling, maybe bugs. He shook Harry fiercely, rattling him against the wall. Harry tried to bring his arms up between them, break the big man's hold. It was like trying to force concrete to yield.
"First everything and everyone you love,"
the vagrant snarled. Then he turned, still holding Harry, and threw him back through the bedroom doorway. Harry hit the floor hard and rolled into the side of the bed.
"Then you..."